चंपक बिल्व पत्र रचितम् पुष्पं च धूपं तथा दीपं देव दयानिधे पशुपते हृत्कल्पितं गृह्यताम्
Good evening, and stay tuned for tonight's Vegan World Radio. We have a very special show for you this evening. Tonight, we're going to be joined by the one and only Bob Linden, creator of Vegan Radio and host of Go Vegan Radio in California, and by renowned law professor Gary Francione, prolific scholar, author, and speaker on veganism, and recently a keynote speaker at the 2011 Houston Jane Convention. We're going to have a roundtable discussion about dairy, compassionate living, and vegan philosophy, among other things. But first, we'll get an update from local vegan Food Not Bombs activist Nick Cooper on the latest on the Houston City Ordinance trying to criminalize feeding the hungry. So tune in for a cruelty-free, compassionate hour of programming on tonight's Vegan World Radio.
Chatram chamar yor yugam vyajanikam chadarshakam nirmalam Veena bheri mridanga kohala kala kitam chanratyam tatha Sashtangam pranati
Sacred Chants of Shiva from the Banks of the Ganges by Singers of the Art of Living Foundation, who are, of course, vegetarian. Good evening. You are listening to Vegan World Radio. This is KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 FM Galveston, and 89.7 FM Huntsville, and actually most recently 90.3 FM Goodrich and Livingston. We welcome you tonight. We are here for you every Wednesday evening with the latest on the vegan revolution happening in our world, one heart, one spirit, and one meal at a time. You can listen to our website, to our show live at our website, veganworldradio.org, and you can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. I am Anuj Shah, and I'll be your host this evening. We have got a lot to cover tonight, so we're going to jump right in. Our first guest this evening is Nick Cooper. Nick is a local vegan Food Not Bombs activist, and he's going to tell us about what's been going on lately. Nick, good evening.
How are you doing?
Good to have you on. Doing great. Listen, thanks so much for being on this late. Tell us what's been going on lately. I think there was a Houston Chronicle editorial about this a week or two ago as well. But for people who don't know, maybe let's start real quick with the beginning. Just tell us, what is Food Not Bombs, and then what has been going on here locally in Houston? And I know a lot of this is going on around the nation as well.
Well, we're an anti-war vegetarian group, and we're also a non-hierarchical group, so we don't have any leaders or managers, and we're all volunteers, and we get together and we serve vegan and vegetarian food downtown, and we do it four nights a week, and homeless people come, and working poor, and hippies and other types of people all come by and have a meal together. It's a very nice kind of civilized experience, and so the city has passed a new law, and the first draft of the law was particularly crazy, and the second draft of the law is kind of looks like it's just as bad because it just is missing so many of the details. But it basically says everyone has to ask permission to share food anywhere in Houston, and if you don't have permission, you could get up to a $500 fine. Now, this would mean that, of course, for groups that go around and just kind of look for some homeless people and say, hey, there's some pullover, you know, there's no way they could get prior written permission. It's just technically impossible. So they would immediately become criminals for trying to take care of homeless people.
So if I understand you right, you said passed. The Houston City Council passed these laws, or they're not at the proposal stage? They've actually been passed?
Yeah, the mayor was fighting for it and pushing it and saying it's an emergency. She never said why it was an emergency, but she declared it an emergency and just pushed it and pushed it and put pressure on people. And, of course, the Democrats have to vote with the mayor because she's, you know, the source of their connection to the party and their funding for other elections that they might run in.
So why was this such an emergency? So just to be clear, basically they're criminalizing feeding hungry people or people who are homeless or people who don't have any food, basically. So if you go out and you share food with somebody who doesn't have food, you could be fined. Is there any criminal sanction possible, jail or anything like that?
This is a crime that's considered a criminal charge, like a lot of other fines. It has a criminal component, which means, you know, if you have a court date and then you miss your court date, it can escalate to going to jail as well. You know, it's just like other misdemeanors. You could just get a ticket or you could get arrested for it. It's really at the police discretion to decide what they want to do on something like that. And, of course, you know, they're saying, oh, well, it'll be very easy. You just ask for permission, and as long as you meet some requirements, which they're not really saying what they are yet, then you'll get permission. So don't worry about it. You'll get permission. What's the big deal? Everyone will get permission.
Well, and where are you supposed to ask for this permission?
It doesn't say yet. The law was written without any permission process in place. And so then we know exactly what's happened to Food Not Bombs chapters when they've created a permission process in the past. They did the same thing in San Francisco in 1988, and Food Not Bombs was completely shut down by it. So they made criteria that there was no way that Food Not Bombs could comply with. You know, first it started off, well, you have to serve over here or not here. And they said, well, we can do that. And then they said, oh, and now you have to do this. And they said, well, we can do that. And then, you know, by the time the third thing had been heaped on there, you know, it was completely impossible to comply with. It was like you have to have an insurance waiver for, you know, $1 million or whatever it is. You know, it's just like, okay, we have now, there's no possible way we can do it. And at that point, the fact that they had been asking for permission all along really worked against them, because they couldn't say, you know, well, we reject the notion that we have to ask for permission, because they had already been asking for permission. So they kind of, the fact that they had asked for permission really was a big negative for them. So it's actually a much smarter legally position just not to ask for a position and fight it on that basis, as opposed to, like, asking permission and have them, like, slowly chisel away from it until you don't have it anymore.
Well, and just for people who may be a little bit new to this, who may not know, I mean, I guess they may be scratching their heads saying, okay, I don't get it. Here are people out there trying to feed the hungry, the homeless, whatever, and now the government, or the at least the city government here, and I know in other places too, is saying, oh, gosh, this is an emergency. We've got to pass this ordinance or whatever so that people can't do this. What would you think would be behind that?
Well, I mean, the cynical answer, I mean, you ask anybody in City Hall off record what's the reason that this is in such a rush, and they'll tell you. They want to evict the homeless populations over near the soccer stadium so they can have their tailgating parties, and they think this law will be one more tool in their belts to evict people.
Hmm. Okay. Well, what can people do? I mean, what are you calling for, is it, at this point?
Well, what we want folks to do is to come out and get involved with Houston Food Not Bombs. We are the only organization that I know of that's serving vegan meals regularly in Houston in the streets. So we are there Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 8 to 9 in front of the library downtown. That's at night, 8 to 9 p.m. And Sundays, we are an hour earlier, 7 to 8 p.m. So come out and get involved. And there's going to be a lawsuit, there's going to be a petition, there's going to be a recall, a repeal, there's going to be all kinds of efforts going on there. We really need help, because if this passes, it's going to mean that homeless people have really terrible food options. It's going to mean they have to hoard food, and it's going to spoil. It's going to mean they're going to go digging in dumpsters. And I've done a lot of interviews with the homeless, and they were very clear about it. They would definitely turn to begging people for money, and they would definitely turn to crime. People said they would turn to shoplifting, no doubt about it, if it wasn't for these volunteer organizations serving in the streets, of which Food Not Bombs is just one of dozens. And our coalition is very broad. We have all kinds of Christian groups and conservative groups and left groups and right groups. The Green Party and the Republicans and the Tea Party and the Libertarians are all signed on to one thing. We do need some Democrats, though. We don't really have enough Democrats in our coalition. So if you're a Democrat, come on. Come out and represent.
Well, so is there any contact information? Is it foodnotbombs.net or something like that, Nick? That's your website?
Yeah, we are on Facebook. It's Houston Food Not Bombs. And we also have the Keep Sharing Free Facebook page you can check out. And, yeah, there's a foodnotbombs.net, but that's kind of a national site that doesn't really deal with the local stuff as much. And so, yeah, we are reachable easily through Facebook under Houston Food Not Bombs. And we are there in front of the library 4 nights a week.
Fantastic. Well, Nick Cooper, a local activist with Food Not Bombs here in Houston, thank you so much for being on with us. And we'll continue to follow this story as you all continue to file your lawsuits and move forward.
Okay, thanks a lot. And the law is going into effect if we don't stop it on July 1st. So let's try to get together and stop this terrible law.
Fantastic. We'll do. Well, thank you again, Nick Cooper of Food Not Bombs, Houston.
Okay, peace.
Welcome back to Vegan World Radio. This is the Vegan World Radio at veganworldradio.org, and I'm Anuj Shah, I'm your host this evening, and we come to the main feature segment of our evening, of our show this evening. We're going to be speaking with Bob Linden, who we have on the line with us, as well as Gary Francione. Gary Francione is the Distinguished Professor of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers Law School. He is actually the first academic to teach animal rights law and theory at an American law school. He's the author of many, many books and articles, most recently Animal Rights Debate, The Animal Rights Debate, Abolition or Regulation. He was a keynote speaker at the 2011 Jane Convention here in Houston just last year. Actually, very impressively, for people who may not know as much about law, he clerked for the for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor at the United States Supreme Court. So for those of you who don't know, that's ridiculously impressive. So we're very happy to have Gary Francione. Professor Francione, good evening.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you very much for having me.
Great to have you. And we also have Bob Linden on the line with us. Bob is so many things. He's the godfather of our show. He's the originator of vegan radio, and I think still the host of the only commercial vegan radio show in the world, if that's still right, Bob. And you're the winner of the Supreme Master's Shining World Hero Award for your incredible love and compassion for all beings. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Anuj. Thank you once again for having me on my second favorite radio show in all the world.
It's always a pleasure to have you guys on. Well, you know, there's
Of course, Democracy Now! Is my first, and then Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden comes in at third.
Okay, got it. Okay, fair enough. Well, I don't know. Amy Goodman is wonderful and all, but I'm not sure she's got the vegan message quite yet, so maybe we can rub off on her somehow.
Okay, take her off the top of the list. Thanks, Anuj.
There you go. Well, you know, there are so many things we could talk about. One thing I wanted to at least start with, you know, Bob and Professor Francione is, you know, Professor.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Great, great. How are you doing?
Well, thank you.
Good. Professor Francione, you know, you were, and I think, Bob, you've spoken at a Jane convention as well. And Professor Francione, you spoke here at the Houston Jane convention just last year. And I was able to see that and listen to it online on YouTube. And, you know, it's so interesting. And there are other topics we'll be talking about this evening as well. But so many people, I think, still feel or just, I don't know what word to use, misguided or just uninformed, and feel that so long as they don't actually eat the flesh of an animal, you know, then and what they're doing is great. And of course, it's certainly, you know, important for people to realize that. But they feel like that, you know, cows, well, they're just, you know, roaming in pastures and they live a really idyllic life. It's very pastoral and whatnot. And they're just kind of lightly milked and they're really happy. And you know, we have sort of an Indian theme tonight a little bit, too, with the music we've been playing and with your being at the Jane Convention last year, Professor Francione, and Bob, too, recently. I know you spoke at the Jane Convention in the last few years, maybe out in California. But, you know, it's like we go to the Gandhi Festival here in Houston, for example, the Vegan Society of Peace, and we table, and all these Indian people will come up and say, oh, well, you know, we love what you're doing and we support it. And anyway, we're vegetarians, so none of this applies to us because we already get it, you know. And I mean, I suppose I could go on. And being of Indian origin, it's a little bit distressing to me that so many of my loved ones and all, you know, while all of them, most of them are vegetarian, they just refuse. It's sort of a blind spot for them. And I thought we could talk a little bit about, you know, dairy and you know, cow's milk and that kind of thing to start to kick off our conversation.
Well, Anuj, I think Professor Francione is you know, really very good at talking a bit about ahimsa, which maybe should be a prelude to it, Gary, do you think?
Yeah, probably. Let me say this. First of all, I think it's you can't really draw a distinction between flesh and other animal products. Indeed, animals used for dairy are kept alive longer. They're treated every bit as badly as animals used for meat are treated, if not worse. And in the end, they all end up at the same slaughterhouse in the end anyway. So, I mean, you can't really draw a coherent moral distinction between flesh and other animal products. What's really interesting is Jainism, for those people who don't know much about Jainism, Jainism is like Buddhism in the sense that it's a non-theistic sramanic, what is called a sramanic tradition. Basically, it regards the material world as inherently flawed, and it counsels people to try to escape or stop the cycle of rebirth through various practices, meditation and observance of particular rules of conduct. Most importantly for the Jains is the doctrine or the principle of ahimsa or nonviolence. And for the Jains, the idea is that one should never do violence in thought, speech, or action. You shouldn't think violent thoughts. You shouldn't speak violently to people, and you shouldn't engage in violent action. And that is really the foundation. That's the central principle of the Jain religious tradition. And what's very, very interesting to me is how tradition-bound human beings really are, because you have this group of people, and they're very serious about this, and they take this principle of ahimsa very, very seriously. They talk about it. I mean, it's the central focus of any discussion of Jainism. And yet, a very large number of Jains are not vegans. They're vegetarians. They don't eat flesh. They don't eat most of them don't eat honey, but they consume milk and other dairy products and paneer, a form of cheese. And it's really quite interesting because when I've spoken at a number of Jain conferences now, and I'm going to be speaking on veganism amongst other things at the Young Jains of America conference this July in Tampa. And what's really interesting is that a lot of Jains just don't make this connection. These are people who accept that it is wrong to engage in any act of violence against a sentient being. But yet, and they accept that eating flesh violates that rule, but they continue to eat dairy. And I've spoken with many of them, and I have very, very high regard for not only the tradition, but for all of my Jain friends. I mean, I have very, very many close friends in the Jain community. And what it goes back to is this idea that, well, you know, my great-great-grandmother had a cow in India, and the cow was a member of the family, and the cow was treated very nicely, and so what's wrong with that? And when you say, well, look, you know, you live in Chicago now, you live in L.A., you live in Houston, you live wherever, you know, even if your grandmother's cow had a really wonderful life, and I doubt that, you know, I don't mean to impugn your grandmother, but I don't think that the cow, you know, I think we mythologize these wonderful lives that these cows have. But even if that were the case, you don't have access to that milk. That milk is not available now. So now you have to choose, you know, now your decision is being made in Houston or LA or New York or wherever, and you can't get that milk, any place. So if you accept that it's wrong to inflict suffering on sentient beings, why are you continuing to consume these products? And it's very, very interesting. There's a really sort of strong tradition that, you know, we've been doing it for a long time, so it must not violate the principle of ahimsa, even though it clearly does on its face. But the good news is, and the positive spin on the story is that, despite the fact that I keep annoying people with these questions, I keep getting invited back to these conferences. And so I'm coming to the conclusion that I think a lot of the Jains, I think there's a transition. I think that, and I would be curious to know whether Bob Linden agrees with this, because he's also close to that community. I think there's a transition happening, and I think a lot of the young people are moving towards veganism now. They see the common sense. You know, I mean, they see that it's simply the common sense implication of accepting the principle of ahimsa, or not doing violence to sentient beings. And I think a lot of the older people are also transitioning, and the fact that, as I say, the fact that they make this issue, they make this topic, you know, they include this topic in all of their conferences, makes me think that they realize that there's something there that they need to think about, and so I think that's a good thing. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I think on one hand it's bizarre that people who have such a strong commitment to ahimsa don't see that there really is no difference between flesh and dairy. On the other hand, I think things are changing, and I think things are changing pretty rapidly within that community. Bob, do you agree?
I definitely agree. I see a big movement toward veganism in the Jain community, and vegan Jain websites popping up. And like you say, the fact that I keep getting invited back for these discussions. You know, I think I had a rogue Jain who had me invited to the 10th anniversary of the Jain Center of Northern California, where I spoke, and he knew that I wouldn't hold back, because I know, I mean, I've spoken at other Jain conferences where I've said, really, I'm saying, you are the Jains, please be Jains. You know, don't come to this country and, you know, get converted by the thinking here. You need to influence this country. You, if you're sweeping in front of you because you care so much about not harming any individual, you know, and then that translates to, well, if you can care for not hurting insects in front of you, maybe we won't use napalm. You know, I mean, it's a whole, you know, broad perspective. So I went to the Jain Temple in Northern California, and my friend there, who made sure that I got invited to speak, had me show the Conklin Dairy cow abuse. And this was, you know, it was a worker on the farm using a pitchfork, poking the cows, punching the cows. This isn't even the worst of what happens to cows. And people in the audience were up in arms. Some were going vegan on the spot. Others were calling for more regulation. And I keep saying, it's not regulation, you know? I mean, if you have to go vegan. And a lot of people understood that, and, you know, immediately, can I have my picture taken with you? And mothers, Jain mothers, are saying, oh, my son is vegan, I'm so proud of him. I haven't been able to do that yet, you know, because, again, you know, there's casomorphin in dairy, right? There's a morphine also. I think that progress is being made, and also with the Krishna community, who invites me out to events, and they keep saying, you know, we're supposed to be drinking milk, you know, it's a divine decree, but we can't get any ahimsa milk now. Any milk you have is from a slaughterhouse, basically. So you have to go vegan.
There really is no such thing as ahimsa milk. I mean, I agree. You know, there are these exposés. Like I was at that. If my memory serves me correctly, I was at that Jain event that you were at.
You were. Yes.
In Northern California. Mm-hmm. That was last year, right?
2 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, whatever. And I remember seeing that Conklin Dairy film that you were showing. And, you know, yes, it's really terrible to see how those cows were treated at that particular place. But, you know, I think those sorts of things tend to sort of focus people on particular places and particular atrocities that occur. And the response from a lot of people tends to be, well, you know, that sort of thing shouldn't happen. There should be rules which prohibit that sort of thing from happening. And my response
to that was, that was a good day for the cows. What I was trying to tell them was, you know, this is a good day for the cows when, you know, when they're being made into veal or hamburger or,
yeah,
you know,
I think it's important to sort of focus people on the fact that, you know, as I tell my students all the time, the most humanely produced dairy or any animal products that you get, I mean, you know, I don't care where you get them from, the very, very best ones in the world are the product of torture. And so kid yourself not that it's not just a question of whether there are abuses going on in particular places. All use is abuse. There is no way you can do this without inflicting horrible suffering and depriving these animals of their lives. I mean, you know, even if it were possible to do it painlessly, which it is not, even if it were possible, it would still involve killing, and that raises, I mean, it would be better if I were going to take your life, it would be better if I didn't torture you first, but even if I killed you painlessly, I would still be inflicting a harm on you. And I think that we really sort of need to focus people on that. And I think a lot of the folks in the Jane community are coming to see that now. And I'm very excited. I mean, I'm very, very excited. And my prediction is that within 10 years, the Jane community in North America, I don't know whether the same will be true for the Jane community in India, but I think the Jane community in North America, in the United States and Canada will be largely vegan.
I think the movement is widespread. I see information this week. There are 7.5 million vegans in the country now. That the number of vegans has doubled in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
So I think it goes beyond Jane now. I think we're hitting everyone.
Well, one thing I wanted to jump in and add to Professor Francione and Bob, of course, is, you know, let's say even in some incredibly crazy, you know, alternate universe or theoretical world that you can have these non-human animals produce this food and these secretions and whatnot, and they would suffer not at all. There would be no suffering. I mean, just to bring it to a practical level, I mean, now, you know, I went vegan in 1989. So back then, I think we still had some options, but now there's an option for anything you would want, anything from whipped cream to sour cream to butter to cheese to 15 different kinds of plant-based milks. I just don't even see, from a practical point of view, why people would. And I appreciate the casomorphine thing, Bob, you know, breaking the food seduction. You know, Bernard, we all know about that. But with all these other options out there, you can get the same taste, the same texture, the same flavor. You can use it for your baking and whatever else. I don't even see why people would.
Without the health risk.
Without the pus, without the blood, without the hormones, without the, you know, the cholesterol and all everything else. Why it would even be an issue? What do you all feel about that? And why do you think people cling to such dear life for these things? You know, apart from the addiction issue, of course, as we know.
I'm not sure how I feel about this addiction business. I've read quite a bit about it, and I'm a tad skeptical. But I actually think, Anuj, that it's something more fundamental. I think it's putting aside whether there's a physical dimension to it, which there may be. But as I say, I'm skeptical. The one thing I'm quite confident of is that there's a sort of a spiritual addiction in the sense that. Our exploitation of animals seems to be an important part, I don't think a necessary part, but it seems to play an important role in the thinking of a lot of people. We celebrate oppression. We celebrate our superiority, our hierarchy, and by exploiting non-human animals. And it's bizarre. I mean, it seems that we, for some reason, many of us need, in order to feel, adequate is probably not the right word, but in order to feel fulfilled in some way, we feel that we have to dominate animals, we have to oppress animals, we have to exploit animals. It's like a spiritual addiction to violence. And that's actually, you know, something that I think, resonates with the Jane thinking, because the Jane thinking is very much that the fundamental spiritual flaw is an attachment to violence, and that's really what the existential challenge for us all is, to sort of break that addiction to violence that we have. That is part of what it is to live in the material world, that by living in the material world, we are always engaging in actions which cause harm, and that what we really need to do is to sort of pull back from that. And so I think, in a sense, and our exploitation of animals is a real direct as opposed to an indirect, it's a real direct sort of manifestation of that attachment to violence. And so I think, in a sense, to the extent that there's an addiction element there, I think it's sort of an addiction to violence as opposed to sort of an addiction to casomorphines or whatever. I mean, I think it's a real sort of attachment to this notion of addiction, or of violence, rather.
I don't know. I've never really been like a biology professor before, but related to violence, I've seen some lectures saying that meat and dairy cause a calcium-phosphorus imbalance that actually leads to belligerent behavior. So I'm on calcium, phosphorus, and casomorphin tonight. I don't know what the subject matter I didn't really expect.
Bob and Professor Francione, if you'll hold, give us a moment. We're going to do a station ID, take a very quick break, and be right back with you. We're speaking with Bob Linden, host of Go Vegan Radio, and Professor Gary Francione, as Distinguished Professor of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University. This is KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.7 FM Galveston. I'm sorry, 89.5 FM Galveston, 88.7 FM Huntsville, and we're at kpft.org, veganworldradio.org. Sacred Chants of Shiva from the Banks of the Ganges from the Art of Living Foundation, who are vegetarian, but alas, not vegan. Professor Francione and Bob, our guests tonight are on. Welcome back to Vegan World Radio, veganworldradio.org. I'm Anuj Shah, your host this evening, and our guests this evening are Professor Gary Francione, Distinguished Professor of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers Law School, and Bob Linden, the godfather of our show and inventor of vegan radio and the host of Vegan World, Go Vegan Radio out in California, going into its 12th year, I think, right, Bob?
That is true. You know, Anuj, I was thinking, you being of Indian descent and Gary entrenched in Jain philosophy, I tend to wonder, what do people of India think of this country here? I mean, if you come from a background where the cow is sacred, how would you look at America? Do we look like a nation of total barbarians? It looks that way to me, but I mean, if the cow is sacred and that's part of your culture, what are we doing here?
Well, I mean, I suppose I can jump in really quickly and say, from my own experience, I mean, my whole family lives in Mumbai, and we're from Mumbai, which is the largest city in India. And it's kind of a combination of Los Angeles and New York, right? I mean, there's Bollywood, which everybody's heard of, so you've got that aspect of it, and then you've got, Wall Street, or, you know, their version of Wall Street. So the main stock exchange is in Mumbai. So, I mean, this is a very metropolitan city, and people are all aspiring to be much more Western than anything. So people wear much more, Western clothes, and they all speak English because it's fashionable. And so I think more and more people eat animal flesh, I don't think they think much of it. I suppose maybe in other parts of India, and maybe Professor Francione can say more about that, but they may look a bit more askance. But, you know, most people look at the United States and the West as they kind of deify it.
Unfortunately, I think that's true. There are a lot of people in the world who think that the materialism of the West, particularly the materialism in the United States, is something to be embraced and celebrated, and not something to be rejected, and so they do. I think they embrace it. I want to go back to this idea, though, for one second about addiction, because the thought occurred to me while I was during the station break, and that is, you know, we justify our harm to other humans by otherizing them, by reducing them to animals. And if you think about, you know, what we've done in terms of whether it's slavery or whether it was the Holocaust or whether it's whatever it is, or, you know, the Islamophobia that we're dealing with now, it all involves otherizing human beings and reducing them to animals. And once we reduce them to animals, once we say, well, you know, these Muslims, they all live in caves, or people of color, you know, the justification of slavery was people of color were subhuman, or the idea that the Aryan philosophy of the Nazis is that the Jews were subhuman in the sense that they were far from the Aryan ideal. It's this idea of otherizing and animalizing the other. And once we do that, we can justify anything we want to do to those people. So, in a sense, our exploits, we're committed to our exploitation of animals if we want to continue our violence towards each other. So we've got to, you know, I mean, it's complex. And so, you know, I don't think it's just a question of, well, you know, I don't think there are simple reasons or simple explanations or why we exploit non-human animals. I think the reasons are really quite deep. And in a sense, if we stopped treating animals the way we treat animals, we really would knock out the basis for the way that we treat a lot of human beings. So in a sense, this sort of web of oppression is all very, very much interlinked. And I think we need to recognize that, because I do think it's complex.
Well, and I just want to jump in real quick, and I know Bob, you wanted to say something too, but I want to say before, I'm not sure what you're going to say, Bob, but it's just embedded in our subconscious or whatever you want to call it. Embedded in our linguistics. I mean, to even say, you know, they treated them like animals. I mean, this is such a common phrase, as though it's completely fine to treat a non-human animal, in an exploitative or harmful way. You know,
exactly. The speciesism is rooted in our language, to where we'll call somebody a pig or a rat or a snake, or, you know, actually, you know, using another species to diminish someone, and it's in our language. We call animals "it," you know, as if they're property or things, you know, instead of him or her. It's, you know, it's deeply rooted. It's interesting. I had historian Rin Berry on my show this past weekend, and he says, "Well, you know, the religions really they've been won over by the sacrificial priests, and so everything is okay. Killing is okay for every holiday, for Thanksgiving, killing turkeys." Fine, you know, an Easter ham, fine. I mean, it's all just, it's gotten the blessing. It's the cultural blessing everywhere. And the only normal ones are the vegans, who are raising their hands saying, look, something's wrong here. You know, this violence is wrong, the murder is wrong, the disease and the destruction of the earth are all wrong. Let's do something about it. And people are hearing the message now. You know, I did also want to talk about H.R. 3798 to change the subject, but...
it's actually kind of linked. I mean, because we're talking about, you know, Professor Francione, one of your ideas has always been about abolitionism versus welfareism, or badfareism, Bob, as you might want to call it.
Yes, I can't even say welfare, because nobody does well at all. Even that hints at better treatment than ever happens. So I can't even say welfare. It's badfare to me.
I mean, I think the transition is apt, though. I mean, go ahead. You want to talk about H.R. 3798 and tell people what that is.
Well, I do, and then, well, actually, again, in terms of maybe we should have talked about AHIMSA first, we should talk about abolition first with Professor Francione, and then talk about what's happening to the animal rights movement. And I'm most upset now because I have friends in the animal rights movement who are saying that this bill, H.R. 3798, which imprisons hens forever in harsh conditions, allows them to engage in natural behaviors. And that is what is being said by animal rights people. So, but maybe we should start at the beginning with abolition and work our way toward that, Gary, do you think?
Yeah, the abolitionist approach to animal rights, as I developed it in the 90s, was that regulation was problematic in two primary respects. First of all, if animals have moral value, then we cannot morally justify exploiting them. And so that's the end of it. The idea, if it's wrong to exploit them, then the program shouldn't be to humanely exploit them, it should be to stop exploiting them. So there was that theoretical notion, if we can't justify animal exploitation, we should stop exploiting them and not focus on regulating exploitation. And the second part of my thinking here was that, as a practical matter, because animals are property, they're economic entities. They have only economic value. They have external, extrinsic value. They don't have any inherent or intrinsic value because they are things. They are property. They're commodities. They're economic commodities. It costs money to protect their interests, and the result is that animal welfare standards will always be. They always have been, and they always will be very, very low. And because it costs money to protect those interests, and the only time we will protect those interests is when we get an economic benefit from it. So, you know, you can look at something like the Humane Slaughter Act of 1958, where, you know, it was required, you know, where the federal government imposed the requirement that large animals be stunned before they're shackled, hoisted, and cut. And the reason why that law was passed was because basically, even though industry put up a fake opposition to it, everybody realized it was economically a very good thing to do, because there were workers that were being injured by animals hanging upside down, moving around a lot, and there was a lot of carcass damage. And so the result was is that, you know, it was economically not a good idea not to stun them. So they decided that stunning would be something that would, you know, that would be a more humane, but it was accepted simply because it was economically justifiable. And if you look at the animal welfare legislation or the voluntary industry things that have happened, you know, over the years, as a matter of fact, I would argue that if you look at the history of the animal welfare movement, starting in the you know, it was past 200 years, basically starting in the 1800s, the early 1800s, what you see is that the welfare reforms, the changes that are made, really do very, very little, and they by and large make the make animal exploitation more economically efficient, not less. If you were going to build a slaughterhouse tomorrow for chickens, you would be crazy to use the electric stunning method. You would go for controlled atmosphere killing. That's a much more economically efficient way of killing chickens. And so I think that most of these animal welfare reforms do really very little in terms of protecting animal interests. And what they really do is they allow industry to portray itself as concerned about animal welfare. They allow animal welfare groups or animal protection groups or whatever you want to call them to declare that they have, you know, that they have victories that we should support with our donations because they've gotten industry or they've gotten the legislature to pass these laws. And but really what these things do is just make the production of animal products more economically efficient. And so my view is, look, this is wrong. You can't justify it. Let's stop wasting our time, you know, getting chickens, you know, an additional inch of space in the battery cages, let's not focus on going from electrical stunning to controlled atmosphere killing. Let's just put our time, our resources, our efforts, our energy into educating people about why they should stop consuming animals. And, you know, we're not going to convince everybody, but you know what? There are a lot of folks out there we could convince if we put the time and effort and energy into it. But unfortunately, a lot of these animal protection groups don't want to do that because they don't want to alienate people. They don't want to ask people to do anything that would require that they actually change their behavior. And what they want to do is to provide, easy but unfortunately meaningless solutions to problems.
Well, and Professor Francine, I just want to jump in. Something you were talking about a couple of minutes ago, you know, on your website, which we didn't mention, but you have a website, abolitionistapproach.com. And it's just got so much information on there. I really recommend people do go to it, abolitionistapproach.com. And on the front page, I think a little bit down, you've got a blog or an article about the comparison between non-human animal exploitation and human slavery. And you say, you know, it's not an exactly analogous, you know, a situation, not a perfect analogy. But maybe say a little bit about that, too, because, you know, sometimes that is kind of what a lot of us feel like. You know, we're the modern-day abolitionists, you know.
Well, you know, this is when I first started thinking about this, about these issues in the 1980s, I started getting into the literature about the regulation of race-based slavery in the United States. And there were lots of rules, lots of laws that supposedly provided protection for slaves. And they didn't work. And they didn't work because slaves were property. And the primary time at which these rules or these laws were relevant was when slave owners did things to slaves. So you had a conflict between slave owner and slave, and the law had to resolve that conflict. And the problem is you've got a conflict between a property owner and a piece of property. And as long as if you're going to have the institution of human property, the slave owner's got to win in all or substantially all of the cases, or else you don't have that institution. And the result was there were lots of laws that protected slaves, but they didn't do anything. And they didn't do anything because slaves were property. And as I was reading this literature about slavery, it sort of occurred to me, this is exactly what happens with non-human animals. We have all of these laws. We've had them for a long time. They don't do anything because they can't do anything, because these are entities that have no intrinsic value. They only have economic value. And they run into conflict. You know, these laws or these regulations become relevant when there are conflicts between humans and animals. Humans have inherent value. They are rights holders. They are moral persons. They are pitted in a conflict. There's a conflict between a right-holding human and a piece of property. It's like saying I'm having a conflict. You know, I have a conflict between myself and my computer. Who should prevail? You would think that's a crazy question. How can you even posit such a silly question? And the thing is, that's exactly what happens when we're talking about animal exploitation. Animals are property. You can regulate it all you want, and it's never going to amount to anything. And the proof of that is we have had animal welfare for 200 plus years now. We're exploiting more animals now in more horrific ways than at any point in human history. It simply doesn't work. It does work to provide these large animal organizations take in a lot of money promoting this stuff, but as far as what it does for the animals, I would say nothing. Indeed, I'd say it's counterproductive, because what it does is it makes people feel that it reassures the public, makes people think that there's a right way of exploiting animals, that if they buy their meat or their animal products with some happy meat label at Whole Foods or one of these other places, that they've satisfied their moral obligations. And the answer is that's fantasy. That's simply fantasy.
Well, because you're working, like you said, within the same paradigm. Because the same way with the slaves, they could regulate it all till, you know, all they wanted, but you still were working within the paradigm of the exploitation of the institution of slavery. That institution remained intact. And it's the same way. The institution of animal exploitation, non-human animal exploitation, remains intact. And people can feel, like you said, they can feel good about the fact that they had a cage-free egg or a, you know, hormone-free or a grass-fed whatever, you know, milk or piece of meat.
It's not even a fact that they had a cage-free egg or an organic egg. They can feel good about somebody saying that it was.
That's right.
You know, I mean, it's never, you know, right now there's this major conflict in California. Someone was arrested. It was supposed to protect his right to produce raw milk. But if you look behind the scenes, what was going on the farm was that they were repackaging commercial eggs and labeling them as organic and selling them for twice the price.
Imagine that. You guys, yeah. I just want to say real quickly, I wish we had hours to talk about this. We just have another 3 or 4 minutes left. So, Bob, I know you wanted to talk about H.R. 3798. Maybe we can talk about that really quickly and then kind of have some closing thoughts. I wish we had another couple of hours, really. This has been great.
Well, H.R. 3798 is important because it affects the lives of hundreds and hundreds of millions of birds, and I think they're really being sold out by the Humane Society of the United States. But, Gary, I talk about this all the time. I'd like to hear what you have to say about this and how we're being sold that these enriched colony cages are an improvement for hundreds of millions of birds. And we're getting this from the Humane Society of the United States, which is a partner with United Egg Producers, Nebraska Farmers Union, Wolfgang Puck. I mean, it's the egg industry itself. Who appointed it to speak on behalf of animals? And I'm getting yelled at for, you know, being divisive in the animal rights movement.
Well, I've been being yelled at for being divisive for 30 years now. You get used to it. the bottom line is that, ironically, Bob, the enriched cage, which is being promoted in this piece of legislation, is something that exists in Europe. And in the, some 5-6 years ago, there was a number of the animal welfare groups in Europe were arguing that the enriched cages were simply nonsense and that they had to go to a cage-free system. Now, I think that they were wrong in saying that a cage-free system is a significant improvement or indeed satisfies moral obligations. I disagree with that. But it's interesting to note that those organizations, Compassion and World Farming, other organizations in Europe were objecting to the enriched cage. But then when they realized they weren't going to get more than the enriched cage, they all stopped complaining about the enriched cage. Now they're all promoting the enriched cage, and you're seeing this now in this piece of legislation to which you've referred, is that this has now come, it's now crossed the Atlantic, and now you have people here promoting the enriched cage that 5 or 6 years ago everybody in Europe agreed was a really bad idea.
But HSUS was against the enriched cage, and now it's for it, and is overturning Prop 2, which it supported, which it promoted.
Yeah, I mean, look, the bottom line is if you regard animals as having moral value, if you think they matter morally, you don't have a choice. It's not a lifestyle matter. You know, where you go on vacation is a matter of lifestyle. If you think animals have moral value, you are morally obligated to stop consuming them. You shouldn't eat them. You shouldn't wear them. You shouldn't use them. You shouldn't exploit them in any way whatsoever. And I think, you know, if
that means to go vegan, I hope
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You go vegan, or as I say, go ahimsic. And stop with all of this nonsense and trying to sort of come up with 15 layers of justification about, well, you know, if we do this and that, do this. Bottom line,
stick,
stuff doesn't work.
Perch, they get some sand, it's a nest, it's crazy, it's driving
me crazy. Exactly, but I think, you know, unfortunately, I think the animal movement in this country and in Europe, Western Europe, for sure, is going in the happy meat direction. This is now the paradigm is shifting, from an overtly welfarist perspective to a happy meat perspective, because I think in a sense a lot of the animal organizations have embraced Peter Singer's idea that killing an animal is not per se harming the animal, because the animal does not have an interest in his or her life, because non-human animals are not self-aware in the way that humans are self-aware. Now, I think that's nonsense. I think that's speciesist. But that is Singer's view. That was Bentham's view in the 19th century. And I think it's been embraced by a lot of the animal groups here and in Western Europe. And so their view is, well, killing animals is really not the problem. The problem is suffering, and we have to improve and lessen the suffering. And the bottom line is, A, I think it's wrong to say that animals don't have an interest in their lives, and B, I think it's complete fantasy to say that we're ever going to be able to exploit animals in a way that anybody could remotely call humane without making a mockery of that word. You can't do it. It's a fantasy.
Well, in the same way Professor Pantione do, I mean, it's the same philosophy that allowed people to hold slaves or to treat women in the way they did, you know, and prevent them from voting or whatever you want to call it, because they didn't have... You know, they weren't equals. They didn't have a soul, or they didn't have their own moral interest. They weren't sophisticated enough. They didn't have a brain. I mean, whatever the arguments were, I mean, it's the same exact. It's the way we're looking at non-human animals today. And we stay in the paradigm. As long as we can keep the exploitation going, then, you know, like you said, you can layer upon layer of justification that, you know, if we increase the size of their cages, or if we give them a little bit more to eat, or if we kill them more instantly or something like that, then it's okay. And I guess that's what you all are talking about, is where we're headed, or we're so...
I just saw a pig being stunned. You know, they sell it like, oh, they don't feel a thing. Watching this pig get stunned and go into convulsions, That's humane?
I've been in more slaughterhouses in my life than I care to think about, and I can tell you that I've been in ones that are supposed to be excellent, and I've been in ones that were supposedly not excellent. You know what? I can't tell the difference. They're all hideous, monstrous, horrible places. And if you care about this issue, and if you think animals have moral interest, if you think they have moral value, if you don't regard them as things, if you don't think that they, you know, that they are simply commodities, then the answer for you is simple. Go vegan. It's easy. It's better for your health. It's better for the planet. And the most important thing is it's the morally right thing to do. I want to make one final comment, because I hear this a lot from people. They say, well, it's not easy to go vegan because it's expensive and it's difficult and it's this and it's that. Bottom line is that I defy anybody to show me that a vegan diet is more expensive or more difficult to obtain than a meat-based diet. I mean, you can get fruits, vegetables, and beans and grains just about any place on the planet. And they generally, as a matter of fact, I mean, they always cost less than animal products do. So this idea that, well, you know, a vegan diet is expensive or is inaccessible to people is nonsense. You can get those processed vegan foods. Yes, they are expensive and they may not be available everywhere, but the bottom line is most processed vegan foods have a lot of salt, no nutritive value, and you probably ought to stay away from them for health reasons. But, a healthy vegan diet is easily accessible, to just about everyone. No, I would take that back and say everyone, and is cheaper than an animal-based diet. So it's easy to do. It's better for your health. Better for the planet. I mean, animal agriculture is an ecological disaster. But again, the most important reason is, if you take morality seriously and you think animals matter, you don't have a choice. You go vegan.
It's the lifestyle of peace. Cindy Sheehan will be on my show this weekend. She's a vegan.
We have 20 vegan. Seconds.
Cesar Chavez, vegan. It is the lifestyle of peace. So,
well, Professor Gary Francione, distinguished professor of law and philosophy at Rutgers Law School in Broad Blinden, the godfather of our show and host of Go Vegan Radio at govegan.com, and Professor Francione at abolitionistapproach.com. Thank you both so much for being on. And I think
thank
the
you
bottom
for
line.
Having me.
Absolutely. Thank you
pleasure.
So much. And the bottom line is go vegan. All three of us are saying that. Our show is, Bob's show is, your scholarship and life work, Professor Francione. Go vegan, please. In loving memory and honor of Shirley as well. It was her one-year anniversary of passing this past Sunday. We'll always remember her. She'll always be with us. As always, thank you so much, Chris, our wonderful sound engineer, for making the show great, and Snail as well. And thank you, audience, for listening.
Anuj, thank you for all the work that you do on your program. And
thank
Bob, you as well.
Thank you all so
Thanks,
much for being
Gary.
On.
Bob Linden, thank you for doing Go Vegan Radio. Oh, that.
All right, gentlemen. Thank everyone for listening with an open heart and mind, and we can all create a world of peace, a world in which all beings are honored. We can create a vegan world. Up next is Damage Control. Thank you for listening to Pacific Radio. You have been listening to Vegan World Radio. And a quick final thought. We got word from Dwayne Bradley, our station manager, that Amy Goodman is going vegan slowly but surely. So thank you very much, Amy Goodman, for doing that.
Not slowly. We need to speed it up, Amy.
Yes, speed it up, Amy. vegan now, not just Democracy Now.
Vegan now.
That's
yeah,
right.
Go vegan now.
All right. Good night, all. Go vegan and God
good
bless.
Good night. Peace.
Peace out.
Sonali Kohatkar, host of the syndicated news program Uprising, and I'll be in Houston on Friday, April 13th, speaking at St. Paul's Methodist Church at 5501 South Main Street at 7 p.m. I'll be addressing topics of social justice, citizen journalism, and the budding human spring, the story of the phenomenal protest around the world, from the global Occupy movement to European austerity demonstrations to the regime-changing Arab Spring. You can also attend a meet-and-greet with me also at St. Paul's Methodist at 6 p.m. Advance ticket purchases can be made online at kpft.org, and all proceeds go to award-winning listener-sponsored KPFT Radio. This is Sonali Kohatkar, and again, I'll be in Houston speaking on Friday, April 13th at 7 p.m. at St. Paul's Methodist Church, 5501 South Main Street. This is KPFT Radio 90.5.